You. I am Beth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beth.
My home group is Buy the Book in Atlantic Highlands. We meet on Monday nights at 6 and 7:30 and also Wednesday night at 8 p.m. If you're ever in our area, we're down by Sandy Hook. My sobriety date is August 1st of 2017. And I had a peculiar mental blank spot when we started on the family afterward, and we completely skipped the chapter that precedes it, which is two wives, which is a really important chapter. You know, in the beginning, my first sponsor, she tore that chapter out of her book, and she just said that it's too male chauvinistic to read. And so I missed out on my first year and a half on the great principles on here. One of the things that I love about this chapter is there's actually 38 spiritual principles, right? Because I get through the 12th step, which says, you know, that I have to practice these principles in all my affairs, or what are all those principles, where I've learned a lot of them in the first, you know, preceding chapters here, but there's a ton more, you know. And in the beginning, and I do understand, and I listen to Bill Schomburg, you know, the writing of the Big Book, right, where he talks about the chapter Two Wives, and he says, you know, you're basically supposed to hand this to your wife, and it kind of summarizes on how you should treat your fragile husband as a child. So I understand that the logic behind thinking that it may not be valuable, but I would challenge today that there's a new way of looking at this if we look at the broader picture. And I would say, instead of calling this two wives, if I call this two relationships, two sponsees, two boyfriends, two husbands, two girlfriends, two wives, would you read it? And so there's lots of useful information in my daily life on how I show up in relationships. So instead of, you know, bringing this home and shoving it up my husband, who's an alcoholic, so I wouldn't help anyways, right? It's if we look at the broader picture of the spiritual principles that we can live by. And in the beginning, we're going to get an understanding. Bill's going to go through the four types of alcoholics. You know, in the beginning, we learned about the three, the moderate drinker, the hard drinker, and the real alcoholic. You know, and then a lot of people say that Lois should have written this chapter and that it was offered to Ann Smith. And then if you listen to Bill Schomburg, he'll say that this was never offered to Ann Smith. Ann Smith was offered a story in the back of the Big Book on what it's like to be a wife of an alcoholic. But Lois really thought that she should write it, and there was a lot of contention or resentment, so Bill Schomburg says, about Lois not having to write this. And years later, she still said that was just a sore subject for a really long time. But I think the gift is that since Bill wrote this, it comes from an alcoholic perspective, right? I can't ask my mom, who's not an alcoholic, to write a chapter on this and be able to relate, because she's not an alcoholic. It's one alcoholic relating to another, which I think was the gift that we got when Bill wrote this for us. So we want to look at the broader picture, and it reveals the impact that our life as an alcoholic has on others. Whether I'm sober or still drinking, I can still be a terror, right? So again, what if it was called two sponsors, two children, two sponsees, right? And it tells me three things. What my alcoholism has done in my life. What actions I can take when dealing with family members. And then it tells me I've got to change and that I need a God to do that. And so that's what I love about this chapter. Everything Bill tells us throughout this Big Book, he has a way of doing it in a style of writing where he ends up telling us things over and over again in different ways. And we're just going to get reinforcement here. So let's begin on page 104. With few exceptions, our book thus far has spoken of men. But what we have said applies quite as much to women. Our activities in behalf of women who drink are on the increase. There is every evidence that women regain their health as readily as men if they try our suggestions. But for every man, or I would say for every alcoholic who drinks, others are involved. And then the four dashes that he puts here is telling us that he's going to start talking to us in another, from another angle, another pronoun here. The wife who trembles in fear of the next debauch, the mother and father who see their son wasting away. Among us are wives, relatives, and friends whose problem has been solved, and that's a beautiful promise right there, as well as some who have not yet found a happy solution. We want the wives, friends, whatever it is, of Alcoholics Anonymous to address the wives, friends of men or women who drink too much. What they say will apply to nearly everyone bound by ties of blood or affection to an alcoholic. Right? If we all picked up spiritual principles in my family, life would be so much easier for me. That doesn't necessarily happen, and I'm not here to force it down their throat. I'm here to make a demonstration. But there are some things, new ways of thinking that my family has adopted or said, wow, you're a completely different person, and I just, you know, how do you get through that, you know? And I get to share some of those things, and they get a little, you know, like, amazed by how I'm living today, because I am a completely different person according to them. As wives, or as friends, as significant others of Alcoholics Anonymous, we would like you to feel that we understand as perhaps few can. We want to analyze mistakes we have made. We want to leave you with a feeling, and this is the beautiful promise, that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to be overcome. I had a sponsee that had horrible relationship problems with her husband when she came in, and I had her come to this. I had her come right here, that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to overcome. There's portions of this chapter that I sent her to. And then in her morning read, because what we do in my sober family is when we read spiritual literature in the morning as part of our 11th step, we take a line and we snap a picture of something that resonated with us and we send it to each other. And in the end, she ended up sending me snippets as she was reading Two Wives because it gave her hope, right? She wasn't there yet. She hadn't been through the 12 steps, but it gave her some hope that maybe her situation with her husband could be resolved. We have traveled a rocky road. There is no mistake about that. We have had long rendezvous with hurt, pride, frustration, self-pity, misunderstanding, and fear. And I have here, like, these are the things that I can't spiritually bypass. Right? In the beginning, when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I learn all these slogans, live and let live, let go and let God, this too shall pass. But these are real feelings. And I have to let them land on me today and do their worst to me. That's emotional sobriety, to identify what's going on in me, to look at the old ideas and beliefs, the result was nil, as to why I have these things, and to let them go. You know, I was just talking to Jill beforehand. I told you about my mom being in this nursing home, and she's a terror, right? She wants to kill herself and everything else. And I had to take her out on Wednesday because God has assigned me the role of a daughter, as our fear prayer says. I am in the world to play the role he has assigned me. You know, I would love to just cut her out of my life and say she's toxic and do what the rest of the world is doing on Facebook. Toxic, 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 done, done, done. But I've been assigned the role. And so I have to ask God to help me show up. But I can still feel lots of frustration with her on Wednesday. She shows up and I take her out to her house and she's 5 hours of negativity and complaining. This is where I need God. Because if Beth's personality pops out, it's not going to be pretty. Because I will make demands on her to act differently. Because I think she should act differently. Because I think I'm God. And I place my security in how she's behaving. Because again, I'm outside looking for something to solve an inside problem. Instead, today I can admit, you know what, this is really frustrating. It's a lot. And let it do its worst to me, but know that that frustration, that hurt, pride, that misunderstanding, that fear I have is not going to kill me. How do I show up with God's help? On my own power, I am not showing up. On my own power, I got something to say, knock it off, and I will use anger to manipulate her to get her to act right. But I've been assigned the role of a daughter. How do I do that? Within reason, right? I don't have to spend 5 hours with her. That was my limit that day. I allowed God to set that limit for me instead of me showing up and going, I'm only going to do this for a certain amount of time. I don't know what God's plan is, and I want to allow him to reveal that in moment to moment. But yeah, I can't spiritually bypass. I have a responsibility to sort out the truth. These are not pleasant companions. And they're not. I'm a relief-seeking missile. I don't like being uncomfortable. I don't like it when these feelings happen. But I've learned today that they're not going to kill me. They are uncomfortable, and that's part of life, is going through uncomfortable things in sobriety. We have been driven to Malden, which is self-pity, Malden sympathy, to bitter resentment. Some of us have veered from extreme to extreme, ever hoping that one day our loved ones would be themselves once more. And isn't that what our families hope for us, right? If we would just show up and be the daughters, the brothers, the sisters, you know, the mothers that we were meant to be. Just like I want them, my mom, to be someone that she's not capable of. When we think about the relationships in our lives, I have people walking on eggshells. I can still make you walk on eggshells in sobriety. Get me up in the morning and then my husband starts talking to me about what's going on for his day right away, my hair will go on fire. Can't you just let me have a cup of coffee? Don't you know that this is what I like in the morning? It's just to relax a little. I don't wake up fully, husband. Right? I could start making demands on him instead of asking in a kind and compassionate way what it is that I want today. I can make him walk on eggshells. Okay. Our loyalty and the desire that our husbands hold up their heads and be like other men have begotten all sorts of predicaments, right? And they, like me, have expectations. And that's what causes my sober suffering. So can I have compassion for them? But first, the golden rule is that I do to others what I do to myself. If I'm not kind and compassionate towards me, that of how I show up and where I default to, that, you know, I can be a real cranky person in the morning. You know, can I be compassionate that that's where I default to know that my husband may have an off morning? Because if I'm not compassionate towards me, I'm not going to be compassionate towards him. That's the golden rule. I do to others what I do to myself. If I'm judgmental and critical of me and have a whole bunch of shoulds of what I should be doing, making rules for myself, boy, oh boy, that's going to come out on one of you somewhere down the road where I'm going to be judgmental, critical, and make rules on how you should be. That's what I'm getting at, is the truth of how I show up and default to these things, and to see they, like ourselves, as the four steps says, are perhaps spiritually sick. Not that I want to run around and just be like, well, she's so sick. Because I don't want to come from that self-righteous place either. The God piece in me, that's the truth about me. Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. How am I getting connected to that in my morning meditation and prayer? So that I go out into this world knowing the truth will set me free. Well, what's the truth? The truth is that I have access to wisdom, power, love, compassion, understanding, because this God lives in me. That's the truth about who I really am. It's just I get separated from that because this mind starts going. And the ego takes over, the bondage of self, and builds walls and creates separation during my day. I want to be connected with the truth that sets me free about who I really am. That's why I said, you know, I don't run around saying I'm so selfish and self-centered. The truth about who I am is I can behave that way, but that is not who I am. If God lives in me, resides in me, and gives me access to all these things, that's not the truth about who I am, but that's how I can behave. So I don't even like to run around and tell you, I am so bad, I'm so selfish and self-centered. I can behave that way is my language. I want to know the truth of who I am. Really important for me in prayer and meditation to affirm that, because I start driving and somebody flips me off and all of a sudden my hair's on fire, you know, or I show up to work and my boss is displeased with me, and I will internalize that instead of knowing the truth that even if ... somebody's displeased with me, I'm still whole. I'm still lovable. I'm still a good worker even though I make mistakes. I've got to get to the truth. Says, we have been unselfish and self-sacrificing. You know, and Anthony has taught me this one, to put questions behind these. We have told innumerable lies to protect our pride and our husband's reputations. Have you told innumerable lies? We have prayed, we have begged, we have been patient. We have struck out viciously, we have run away. We have been hysterical. We have been terror-stricken. We have sought sympathy. We have had retaliatory love affairs with other men. Right, so I ask myself about my own behaviors here. If Bill's saying that they've done this stuff because they've had reactions to us and they want to fix, manage, and control, and when they don't, they've got hurt, pride, frustration, and pity, that they live quite like alcoholically like us, but they're not going to drink and they're not going to die over it. Our homes have been battlegrounds. Listen, I spent years traumatizing everyone around me that was in my house. In the morning, we have kissed and made up. Our friends have counseled, chuckling chucking the men, and we have done so with family, only to be back in a little while, hoping, always hoping. Our men have sworn great solemn oaths that they were through drinking forever. I have done that. We have believed them when no one else could or would. Then in days, weeks, or months, a fresh outburst. Listen, I'm a great conner and manipulator with my family. Absolutely love getting in there and manipulating these situations. And then we have our sister program, right? Because Al-Anons are just as addicted to us as we're addicted to alcohol. That's the insane part. I just found out, you know, one of my girlfriends is in a relationship, and she says she's a heavy drinker. And I'm looking at this guy, and I'm like, she might be an alcoholic even, and I'm listening to some of the things she's telling me about him, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, like he needs Al-Anon. And, it, you know, sober minded today, I wouldn't touch half the guys that I touched with a 10-foot pole because they were just as alcoholic as me. Mm-hmm. But then I would turn into the Al-Anon and I would look at them and I'd be like, well, you're worse than me. Let me fix, manage, and control. I think I'm Beth the Builder. Let me change you. We seldom had friends at our homes, never knowing how or when the men of the house would appear. We could make few social engagements. We came to live almost alone. When we were invited out, our husbands, our friends, our significant others sneaked so many drinks that they spoiled the occasion. If, on the other hand, they took nothing, their self-pity made them killjoys. And I have been a real killjoy. You know, that boyfriend telling me that we're going to go to that holiday event, and if I pick up one drink, you know, it's over, we're done. And then I got to white-knuckle that holiday, and I'm just, you know, restless, irritable, and discontent, and I'm going to make him pay for this, you know? I'm going to be as bitchy as I can in the car right there and in the back. I'll put on a smile when I'm at his family's house, but God, if he pulls me alone inside, I'm going to give him the nastiest look, right? I'm very retaliatory like that. And then he's got to walk on eggshells around me, and then I wonder why, right? Because I think it's his fault, and I don't want to look at my own behavior. There was never financial security. Positions were always in jeopardy or gone. An armored car would not have brought the pay envelopes home. The checking account melted like snow in June. Sometimes there were other women. How heartbreaking was this discovery. How cruel to be told they understood our men as we did not. You know, in the beginning of AA, there were not a lot of women. And when women started coming around in Akron, you know, Lil was one of the first women that came around, and the wives were petrified of having women there. Because what do? I don't know about you, but when it says from Scotch to Brandy in the book, all the things that we switch, I go, yeah, from Scott to Randy, right? Because that's how I showed up when I was drinking. I didn't care. The bill collectors, the sheriffs, the angry taxi drivers, the policemen, the bums, the pals, and even the ladies they sometimes brought home, our husbands thought we were so inhospitable. Joy killer, nag, wet blanket, that's what they said. Next day, they would be themselves again, and we would forgive and try to forget. And isn't that how I was in most of my relationships? Right? You're spoiling my time. Because you don't want me drinking. You're the problem, not me. And then we'd get into some horrific fight. They'd end up pulling out of the driveway and telling me they're leaving me forever. And then I'm running outside, throwing myself across the hood, spread eagle, go, don't leave me. You know, absolute insanity. And then the next morning, waking up like nothing ever happened. Completely insane. We have tried to hold the love of our children for their father. We have told small tots that father was sick, which was much nearer the truth than we realized. They struck the children, kicked out door panels, smashed treasured crockery, and ripped the keys out of pianos. In the midst of such pandemonium, they may have rushed out threatening to live with the other woman forever. In desperation, we have even got tight ourselves. The drunk to end all drunks. The unexpected result was that our husbands seemed to like it. Boy, oh boy, if you drank with me, I thought it was the best thing in the world because then maybe you weren't looking at me so hard, right? And I don't have kids, so I can't speak to this experience entirely, but the relationships I had, boy, I tore up the house one night. I was just so angry about something, just throwing things down the stairs, breaking my own stuff. I mean, talk about making somebody walk on eggshells because how I behave when I show up. I had no idea. And then I would wonder why they would be so tight, because they got tight ourselves here. Perhaps at this point we got a divorce and took the children home to father and mother. Then we were severely criticized by our husband's parents for desertion. Usually we did not leave. We stayed on and on. We finally sought employment ourselves as destitution faced us and our families. And isn't that what we see with Al-Anons, right? I'm going to stay. I'm going to fix it. You know, I'm going to tough it out. We began to ask medical advice as the sprees got closer together. The alarming physical and mental symptoms, the deepening pall of remorse. Can I relate to this? Oh, yeah. Depression, absolutely. And inferiority, yes, I'm the worst of the worst. The next day after, causing hell, causing that fight at home. Oh, boy, did I feel the remorse. Did I feel the inferiority like I'd really screwed up. That settled down on our loved ones. These things terrified and distracted us. As animals on a treadmill, we have patiently and warily climbed, falling back in exhaustion after each futile effort to reach solid ground. Most of us have entered the final stage with its commitment to health resorts, sanitariums, hospitals, and jails. Sometimes there were screaming delirium and insanity. Death was often near. Like, when you think about this and our behavior and the places that we've been to, the health, the hospitals, the jails, right? This is the traumatizing effect that my impact has had on my family. You know, I don't like to look at that. The day that I bottomed, my last bottom, you know, I was in the hospital. I was taken there and in an ambulance because I stopped breathing in front of my father. You know, I'd already been jailed numerous times and in the hospital numerous times, and now I stopped breathing in front of my dad. Get in the car, and he tells me I'm uninvited to his house, that he's driving me back to his house so that I could pick up my car, that he's called my mother that he hasn't spoken to in 10 years, because, see, he left my mom for a deaf woman after 30 years of marriage. Now my mom knows that I've been in the hospital for you know, alcohol-related. And what do? I don't think about him. I start screaming at him. He's telling me I need to go to rehab, and I'm thinking, I got to go to work tomorrow. You're going to ruin my life if you send me to rehab. And how dare you call my mom? Selfish self-centeredness, the root of our troubles. I'm not thinking about, I'm an only child, his only little girl. I don't have a care for him in the world. I'm thinking, I can't believe you did this to me. Me, 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 me. I have no idea what I've done to this family, and I've never once thought about it. Under these conditions, we naturally make mistakes. Some of them rose out of ignorance and alcoholism, right? And that's why we tell people, it's read more about alcoholism and to employers, right? So important. But again, people don't have to understand. I have to understand it to know that I'm an alcoholic. Sometimes we sense dimly that we were dealing with sick men, and we are sick people. Had we fully understood the nature of alcoholic illness, we might have behaved differently. Right? I thought my problem was alcohol when I get on here. And so do they. Right? I sit in AA thinking that alcohol is my problem. And then my sobriety is based on a lie. What I learned by working these steps is that this disease centers in my mind. That alcohol doesn't come in cans and bottles. Alcoholism comes inside me. And I still have alcoholism today with 6 years sober. And that is the mental state that precedes the relapse. The things that I have to work on and get down in black and white is these defects of character, these defenses, the things that I default to that are going to get me fearful, squirmy, annoyed, crazy, resentful, and are going to lead me back to a drink. Or those bedevilments, the spiritual plaque that builds up in time. Right? Having trouble with personal relationships. I'll give you more power over my mind than I have. You know what? You can have all the power to piss me off. You know what? You're making me feel pissed, Al. Right? Nobody has the power to make me feel a certain way, but it's easier to blame you than to look at what's going on inside me and see what's really going on. That I have expectations and demands. That I place my security in you. I make you my higher power. That I don't have relationships with people. I have reactionships. That we couldn't control our emotional nature. When I can't control my emotional nature and I'm just running around living based on how I feel and telling you how I feel because I'm flying off the handle at something, and now my feelings are my master instead of a servant and telling me what's going on in me. That's how my feelings serve me. They tell me what's going on, that there's something going on in me that's deeper, that's got to be looked at. Right? But I make them my master, and I just walk around blaming everybody for how you make me feel and flying off the deep end when I'm driving in the fast lane and you're going the speed limit because didn't you get the memo this morning on how you ought to drive? Don't you know who I am? Right? When this stuff takes over and keeps ruling me, which is why I look at my nightly review questions, where was God not showing up in my life, or where did I leave him in the back seat because I just didn't want him? Because I like that a little endorphin rise. I like that a little self-righteousness still. That's dangerous for me. So that's why I love this program and looking at these things that pop up for me. It says, how could men who love their wives and children be so unthinking, so callous, so cruel? And again, it's because they don't understand alcoholism. Right? I really loved my dad. I really didn't want to stop breathing in front of him and be hauled off in the hospital and scare the piss out of him. There could be no love in such persons, we thought. Right? They see how selfish we are. Right? And just as we were being convinced of their heartlessness, they would surprise us with fresh resolves and new attentions. Right? After I've made you walk on eggshells for a few days and really thought that I retaliated and got you back for whatever, you know, I assumed you did to me. Right? Then I walk, I'll treat you loving and kind. I may be gracious, I may be kind, but if that's not working, on the other hand is our third step. I may be, right? I'm trying to get my way. I may be angry, indignant, and all these things. For a while, they would be their old sweet selves, only to dash the new structure of affection to pieces once more. Right? I go back and I pull the walls down and the ceiling comes crashing down on their head, as it says early in our book. Asked why they commenced to drink again, they would reply with some silly excuse or none. Right? And our page 23, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting in the cycle, the terrible cycle in motion, right? But we know today that the main problem centers in our mind, right? If sobriety was enough, just complete abstinence, as Silky says, right? If that was just a single-headed problem, I would be fine today, but I have alcoholism. When I put the drink down, that's when I'm untreated. That's when everything really starts to get, the noise gets really loud in my head, and I come into AA and you guys tell me, one day at a time, or 1 minute at a time. And I hear you say it like it's this great thing, but I think, oh my God, I can have this noise and this craziness and this angst and this frustration one long minute of a time. You know, and I have no conception of what it's like to take this action, take these 12 steps, to have a spiritual awakening, and that I will find peace, because I've never had peace in my life. I never even desired peace. And we know the silly excuses, right? And earlier in our book, it tells us, you know, why, right? We'd always come up with some trivial excuse, right? We ask newcomers all the time, well, what do you think happened? Why? Because I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic and I have a mental obsession that's going to continually bring me back to the first drink, that's going to set off that phenomenon of craving once I take it. It was so baffling, so heartbreaking. Could we have been so mistaken in the men we married? When drinking, they were strangers. And Jill, you and I just talked about this, right? We see that change in people now. I go to weddings and it's like, oh my God, when that change in all of them happens, that's when it's time for me to go. That's one of my rules. So even on Thanksgiving, when my family's drinking, all of a sudden they turn into different people, time for me to hightail it out of there. I show up early, I'm a blessing, I chop wood and carry water, but once that changes, time for me to go. Sometimes they were so inaccessible that it seemed as though a great wall had been built around them. Yeah, I built up lots of walls around them because I have been spiritually sick. And even if they did not love their families, how could they be so blind about themselves? Well, we know why we're blind about ourselves. We don't even want to look at ourselves. It's easier to blame you. What had become of their judgment, their common sense, their willpower? And we know willpower doesn't work. Why could they not see that drink meant ruin to them? Why was it when these dangers were pointed out that they agreed and then got drunk again immediately? And we know why. Because we're powerless. We have no power, choice, or control. I have a mind that's going to continually be hijacked either suddenly or slowly over time. That it's going to tell me that I'm going to be able to drink and it's going to be different. These are some of the questions which race to the mind of every man or woman who has an alcoholic significant other. So sometimes I change the pronouns here so that sponsees can relate a little more easily. We hope this book has answered some of them. Perhaps your husband has been living in that strange world of alcoholism, and here it is, where everything is distorted and exaggerated. I can still distort things and exaggerate. That's the insanity of it. Boy, you ask me about doing something, and you know, I don't want to do it, and I could just say no. But you know what? I want to look good. So I'm going to exaggerate and rationalize and justify and give you a big, long, running stream of my thoughts on why I got to say no to you instead of just saying, nope, can't do it. Like, it's insane because it's still distorted up here. There's something in me that tells me that if I do that, that maybe you'll like me more. Or maybe I'm not like, so I got to tell you the five things I got going on in my life and why I can't do that. When really, I don't have anything going on most of the time. I just don't want to do it. I get to say no. And then, you know, I think I told you guys, I always had to be right. I was always trying to control my environment to feel comfortable. And I think that's why I over-exaggerate and give you a long explanation on why I can't do something. Because I think that maybe doing that, that's going to make me feel comfortable. And it's insane. You can see that he really does love you and his better self. Of course, there is such thing as incompatibility, but in nearly every instance, the alcoholic only seems to be unloving and inconsiderate. It is usually because he is warped and sickened. And that is true, right? I'm warped and sickened. I have been insane. I did not know that, and that God can heal that. Warped and sickened that he says and does these appalling things. And then here's the promise. Today, most of our men are better husbands, wives, and fathers, mothers than ever before. Okay, here's one of the first principles. Try not to condemn your alcoholic husband or wife. No matter what he says or does, he is just another very sick, unreasonable person. Man, I can be so unreasonable, and isn't that true? Even when I'm dealing with sponsees, my job isn't to condemn them, right? My job is to share and keep it in the eye. This is what happened for me. This is what I had to do, right? I'm not here to say, you know, oh, yeah, you know, I really wouldn't have done that when I told you not to date in the first, you know, couple months until we get to your fifth step where you can actually see the wrongs that you've done, right? No, when I was sober, newly sober, my sponsor said to me that I should not date until I've done my fifth step to know the wrongs so that I don't continue to repeat them, because there's a big warning in our fifth step that says that if I do not understand and I continue to repeat that behavior, that I am most likely to drink again. Not, you're so bad, you shouldn't have done that. You know what they say in AA. Leave the you, and I keep everything in the eye. And if I don't have experience, that keeps me right size so that I have humility not to think that I have all the answers. Because I'm an alcoholic. I think I have all the answers. Treat him when you can as though he had pneumonia. When he angers you, remember he is very ill. Right? God saved me from being angry. Right? I don't curl up with people in pneumonia. My mom, perhaps spiritually sick, right? Calls me evil, calls me a lot of those words. This is one of those things. When I can, I treat her like she has pneumonia. I have sympathy for people who have pneumonia. I have compassion and understanding for people that have pneumonia. It's a different way of looking at it instead of, she's so spiritually sick, you know? How do I get to the place of love, compassion, understanding, comfort, rather than me wanting to be loved, comforted, and understood? We treat them like they have pneumonia, remembering, right? I don't curl up with people in bed that have pneumonia. There is an important exception to the foregoing. We realize some men are thoroughly bad intentioned, that no amount of patience will make any difference. And this is really important with sponsees, especially since I've had women that says husbands were physically abusing them. It says, an alcoholic of this temperament may be quick to use this chapter as a club over your head. Right? And that's the other thing. I don't want to club people over the head with this big book. Yes, I love the big book. Yes, for some reason I'm able to quote things in it. But I want to keep my experience sharing that in the eye versus clubbing you over it. Don't let them get away with it. If you're positive he is one of the type, you may feel he had better leave. Right? That gives us direction right there. If you're in a completely toxic relationship, right, where somebody's abusive to you, I bring them here. I'm not here to tell you what to do. That's between you and your God. But I'll point you to the area in the book that you can read, and then you can make that decision with God in prayer. But we don't say stick it out all the time. It'll get better. Is it right to let him ruin your life and the lives of your children, especially when he has before him a way to stop his drinking and abuse if he really wants to pay the price? The problem with which you struggle usually falls within one of the four categories. And then here we go. Number one, your husband may be only a heavy drinker. His drinking may be constant, or it may be heavy only on certain occasions. Perhaps he spends too much money for liquor. It may be slowing him up mentally and physically, but he does not see it, right? Relapse, 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 relapse. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you and his friends. He's positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary in his business. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. The world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether, and some will not, right? Pages 20 and 21. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while. Number two, and I compare myself when I'm going through this with my sponsor, right? That is not me. Number two, your husband is showing lack of control, right? Page 44. If when you drink, you have little control over the amount you take, right? Lack of control. For he is unable to stay on the water wagon even when he wants to. He often gets entirely out of hand when drinking. He admits this is true, but is positive that he will do better. Someday I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking. He has begun to try, with or without your cooperation, various means of moderating or staying dry. Maybe he is beginning to lose his friends. His business may suffer somewhat. He is worried. He is fearful, right? Worried at times. And he is becoming aware that he cannot drink like other people, right? The delusion like we are like other people has to be smashed. He sometimes drinks in the morning and through the day also to hold his nervousness in check. Restless, irritable, discontent. He is remorseful after serious drinking bouts and tells you he wants to stop. But when he gets over a spree, he begins to think once more how he can drink moderately next time, right? It won't burn me next time, right? He has a brain hardwired to drink again, regardless of the consequences, is what it sounds like, right? These are the earmarks of a real alcoholic, right? The behaviors, the personalities that we demonstrated, right? The manipulation, the passive aggressiveness type of thing. Perhaps he can still tend to business fairly well. He has by no means ruined everything. As we say to ourselves, he wants to want to stop, right? He desires to want to stop, right? And like Fred the accountant, we know where that got him, right? I find that when it comes to sponsoring, the number ones and number twos are the ones that don't stick around and are the hardest to work with because they're not really willing to fully surrender. Now we get into number three. This husband has gone much further than husband number two. Though once like number two, he became worse, right? Progression, right? We have a progressive illness. His friends have slipped away. His home is a near wreck, and he cannot hold a position. Maybe the doctor has been called in, and the weary round of sanitariums and hospitals began. He admits he cannot drink like other people, but does not see why. Why? Because he hasn't been to AA and read our book, right? He clings to the notion that he will yet find a way to do so. He may have come to the point where he desperately wants to stop, but cannot. His case presents additional questions, which we shall try to answer for you. You can be quite hopeful of a situation like this. And this is why I like working with number threes. Reading with them and aligning their own experience so that they can see why they can't and the delusion that we live under. And number four, I consider myself a number four. So again, we look at our own experience with our drinking career with these. You may have a husband or a wife of whom you completely despair. He has been placed in one institution after another. He is violent or appears definitely insane when drunk, and that is so me. Sometimes he drinks on the way home from the hospital, and that is what I did when I left the hospital after what I did to my dad. Perhaps he has had delirium tremors. Doctors may shake their heads and advise you to have him committed. Maybe you have already been obliged to put him away. This picture may not be as dark as it looks. Many of our husbands and wives were just as far gone. And then here's the promise. Yet they got well. Let's now go back to husband number one. Oddly enough, he is often difficult to deal with. He enjoys drinking. It stirs his imagination. His friends feel closer over a highball. Perhaps you enjoy drinking with him yourself when he doesn't go too far. You have passed happy evenings together, chatting and drinking before your fire. Perhaps you both like parties, which would be dull without liquor. We have enjoyed such evenings ourselves. We have had a good time. We know all about liquor as a social lubricant. Some, but not all of us, think it has its advantages when reasonably used. You know, I can definitely say that I used alcohol to not feel so self-conscious. I think being self-conscious can be a really painful thing to go through in sobriety. And so I work for Anheuser-Busch today, and that's the miracle of it, that I can work for an institution, because we don't hate the institutions, that I'm free to go anywhere where alcohol is served because I have spiritual disciplines, especially a lot of the things that come in the last chapter with working for others. I show up to be a blessing. I'm employed by God as my employer, even though I'm employed by this company, Circana, that works inside Anheuser-Busch. But I used to think that I could never show up to a happy hour anywhere because in early sobriety, I had to do a lot of things to be accountable. I had to have someone to call before and after. I had to get on my knees and pray. I had to go early, leave when that atmosphere changes. And one of the best advice that I was given was be interested instead of trying to be interesting. Right? And what keeps me out of self-consciousness today, as opposed to having a social lubricant, which will kill me, is as I show up today and I interview people, because who doesn't like to talk about themselves? Especially us, but, you know, that's my job today. You know, ask them about their families. Ask them about their jobs. Stop thinking about me and think about how I can be interested in you instead of thinking that I need to be interesting. Because that self-consciousness is really just a painful thing to be in. There's always a way out of it. Even when I go through problems in life, my sponsor will say, who did you call today, Beth? In the beginning, she said, why don't you call three people and say, how are you, and not talk about your stuff? Because all of a sudden, my feelings change. Now I'm being helpful and useful to someone else, and I'm not thinking about me. And so that's probably some of the best advice that I've ever gotten that I still use today, especially around holidays. My Thanksgiving was with my dad's family. It's his wife's family, the deaf woman, you know? And so I show up there, and I don't know them. I see them once a year on Thanksgiving. My job is to be interested and ask them questions. That's how I get through the holidays. So we'll end there, and we'll go through the next principles on my last meeting with you guys next week. And if anybody would like to share on this or talk about it, we've got a couple minutes.